Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Happy Friday. Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Michelle Pache, co-host today, filling in for Jeannie. We warmly welcome you to the show, and thank you for being with us. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk with our host. We encourage you to call in with your comments or questions, allowing you to actively strengthen your practice. Let's now welcome Michael in the conversation for developing our understanding of Aramaic forgiveness.
Well, thank you, young lady, for that introduction. We appreciate your support, and we're honored to be here to have this conversation with everybody that chooses to participate. And, of course, the conversation is about primarily first century Aramaic forgiveness. We've been dealing with it the last few days from a slightly different language perspective that comes from one of the most important events to ever happen on planet Earth, and that is that Disney has made the shift into working in the light. That would be my way of expressing it. That might not be Disney's way of thinking about it, but they've made the shift into expressing from the perspective of working in the light, and they've just come out with what I consider to be one of the most important events in history, and that is a movie that does an honest inquiry into how the human mind works and how the healing process works. So we've been talking about that for the last few days, and I'm sure we'll probably bring it up in some way, shape, or form because it gives another whole common language for looking at the first century Aramaic forgiveness process and how healing happens, what the true active presence of love means, and how it changes the dynamics within one's own mind. One of the pieces of the puzzle that occurs to me that I haven't shared, I've been, of course, talking to a number of different people about it, and as I do, it refines more and more pieces of the puzzle. But there was some conversation yesterday about how it touches people so powerfully emotionally. And in talking with someone actually just before the show, I was talking with someone about the movie and explained to them they haven't seen it yet, and they've got a parent who's dealing with cancer. And so my suggestion was get with them and get them there, and it'll give a whole different context to emotions and a whole different language for dealing with them. And the number of people who shared when they've gone to see the film how it touched them emotionally and brought forward sadness, grief, and they, the others, the adults and the teenagers and the kids in the film who are sitting there in tears. And in talking with him this morning, I realized that one of the things that the movie does is that it touches one of the most important core pieces of the puzzle that needs to be healed. If you've done our codependence to interdependence workshop, you know that we talk about being. The first thing we do when we open a Y workshop is Jeannie asks the question, how many have ever held a newborn child? And then we ask people to put the essence of the newborn child into a single word. And
everybody's word, wherever we've asked it of tens of thousands of people all over the globe, everybody's word is always some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because everybody knows what that is. Everybody knows that we are human beings, and though we've not languaged it that way, our being is love. The movie opens with the birth of a child, really cute little graphic of this cartoon face, really sweet face child, and then it zooms inside her head, and you're introduced to the real being. The little girl's name is Riley, and the being is called Joy. And Joy, you'll notice, has a light around her, which she never loses throughout the film, no matter what happens to her. But the realizing in this conversation I had with this young man just a few minutes ago that what happens is we all come in as that awesome active presence of love and light. And then the world, as the film so aptly demonstrates, starts to put its thumbprints on us. And those thumbprints are the emotions. And when the being starts to identify more with the emotions than the truth of who it is, then one, innocence is lost. And the direct connection to that awesome active presence of love that's designed to fire every cell is lost. The moment at which the power person, and in our codependence workshop we introduced the concept of a power person. And a power person is a person in your life who at some time in your life had more power over your life than you did and wasn't functioning as love, had lost contact with their joy, their being. And that power person delivers messages to the child. You know, some of the craziest messages, one of the most bizarre ones I've ever heard, and I've heard hundreds of them from people, was a woman who shared that when she was 6 years of age, her father came to her and said that until she came into the family, they had a perfect family. And his six-year-old, her father, delivers the message, and you destroyed the family. So you look at that kind of message, and what happens is we build a self that isn't who we are out of those messages. And when enough energetic dynamics of fear, of anger, of disgust, as the movie puts forward, and of sadness come forward, it formulates or shows up as a self. I would term it the self that isn't. And when we get lost in the self that isn't, we've given up the connection to joy, the connection to being. When every cell is firing on that awesome active presence of love as we are designed to exist, every cell is in ecstasy. Every cell is in pure joy. It's the natural state of a human being. But when we build this picture in our minds based on the messages from our power person and the thumbprints from the world, there comes a point where we lose our connection to joy. We fall into identification with the non, what we call the non-being self, the self based in the messages of hostility and fear. You're not good enough. You're stupid. You'll never make it. I wish you were a boy. I wish you were a girl. Whatever those messages are. And that mind energy becomes a literal picture in the mind of the self that we think we are as a body, and we lose contact with being. And that is the moment where that happens, and everybody goes through it. I've never met anybody that doesn't. I shouldn't say everybody, because maybe there's somebody out there, but I've never met anybody who hasn't gone through it, is the moment of the most intense pain, the withdrawal from the cell of the ecstasy that's meant to run, that happens in the cell when it's run by love, is excruciatingly painful. You know, they talk about the terrible twos. That's what the terrible twos come from. And that moment where that happens is so deeply lost in long-term memory, as the movie talks about it, that it's a difficult one to recover and tell the truth about. And when that connection to being is lost, when the cells are no longer fired by the presence of love, but are fired by messages of hostility and fear, that they become the energy that runs the structure. That is the moment of the most intense rage. That's the rage that people say, oh, I never want to feel that because if I did, I'd kill somebody. I would never stop. That's the pain that if I ever started to shed tears over that one, I would never stop crying. I've heard many people say that, both of those things over the years. That's the moment where being is lost and the ecstasy and the joy and the aliveness of human life is lost. And then we start searching for somebody to love us because we've lost our connection to love, and we identify ourselves as something that we're not. And sadly, because the church leaders haven't resolved that, most of the church leaders just reinforce that by telling people what sinners they are and all of that garbage. And it's garbage. It's garbage. But if we buy that, we lose connection to the being that we are. And I think that that's what happens when joy gets lost in long-term memory. And there's a beautiful portrayal there, because even lost in long-term memory and all the things that happened to her there, the light is still around her. Your light, your being, is the message that I get out of that, and the message we've been delivering to people for decades, is your being is intact no matter what you've done or no matter what's happened to you. All you need to do is remove those things that block awareness of it, and the full-blown state of ecstasy and bliss are returned to you. It's always there. It is never touched by anything that happens in your life. And so in having this conversation with this young man just a few minutes ago, I realized, that's what the emotional response is for many people as they're sitting there. And I don't care whether it's a 7-year-old or it's a 93-year-old, you know, that point where she's lost resonates the feeling that everybody's been through and gives the opportunity to bring that forward and process it. And for those reasons and all the other reasons that go with it, I believe this is one of the most monumental events to happen in the whole of human history. Because we now have a way on a global scale that any young person, any child, any old man, any old woman, any diseased person can look and go, oh my God, what's running my control panel? And for this mom who called in, and thank you for that piece, Maureen, called in and said, you know, and I hand my child anger and, you know, how long do you want to hang on to it? Do you want to let go of it? What's driving your anger? Become aware that you've got a goal that's driving your anger. Are you willing to do a worksheet and cancel that goal and then reach for the joy doll and re-embrace joy? It's like, it's just awesome. So that's what's on my mind for today to share with y'all, and it's just a privilege and an honor to be here and to have you joining us. So, Dr. Tim, how do you be today, sir? Do you have any thoughts for us?
I am well. I'm just finishing a mouthful of food, but I am well.
Cool.
We had our group last night, and
Tell us about it.
Again, another lovely group. We had some comments at the beginning that referenced the topic in the show yesterday of the couple where one feels offended or betrayed and labels themselves a victim and the other one a perpetrator, and then they decide with the help of a therapist that the only way out of that is to give the victim complete and total control over the perpetrator for an indefinite period of time until the victim feels empowered again. And so that was the kind of craziness that we talked about in the show yesterday, and it came up as a question. So it led to a discussion about my power struggle model and how I teach people about that, and credibility, how I build my credibility by matching my words to my actions, and the need to end secrecy, because that's a primary necessary ingredient, a requirement for abuse to continue. And then we showed a TED Talk by a woman, a graduate of Harvard College, and then an MBA, and a very, you know, competent professional woman, Leslie Morgan Steiner, and she gives a talk on why domestic violence victims don't leave. And she's a very well-dressed woman standing on stage next to a stool and talks a little bit about her career as a graduate of Harvard Business College and all that good stuff, and then walks over to the stool and opens up a purse and pulls out a very large handgun. And she says, "And I've had this loaded handgun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head more times than I can remember by the man that I loved and lived with." So it's a very powerful
talk.
It's only about 15 minutes, 16 minutes. And so we showed that in the group, and then we discussed more about how this happens and the different factors that Leslie points out, that, you know, one of the biggest reasons abuse like that is so prevalent in our culture is that nobody expects to find it in the home. Nobody knows what to look for the early warning signs, and nobody expects they're going to end up in that situation. And when they do, it grows gradually. It's not like somebody meets you at a coffee shop and says, "Look, you're very attractive, and I'm looking for somebody to brutally abuse for the rest of my life. You want to come home with me?" You know, that's not how it works. It works with a system of praise and putting someone up on a pedestal, and the person who is eventually labeled as the perpetrator being vulnerable. And it's just a very good talk. And then she makes the point that we really just need to get the word out there. And then we need to end the secrecy at every level and offer support to people who might be engaged in those patterns of abuse on either side and help them have the resources that can put an end to that. So it was a powerful group, and then we just talked about a lot of different things that came up from that. So.
Very cool, very powerful. When we really start to look, it's amazing. I talked to a couple of people yesterday who shared, you know, another aspect of what you're just talking about there, and that's the rampant sexual abuse that's happened on the planet to both males and females, and how destructive that is to being. And once again, it's just another energetic pattern to be forgiven, to be embraced in love and removed. You know, that scene toward the end of the film where, you know, Joy finally gets back in charge of the control panel, and Riley, the little child, tells the truth about her sadness and her feelings of loss and grief, and then the parents do the same, and then in the space of love they embrace. I mean, they just show here's the core of healing, folks. Here's how it happens. And you know, that has been available to pockets of people on the planet for a long time, but not to the general population and not to the children of the world. And now we've got a tool, a mechanism that just lays it out there so clearly, so succinctly, and so simply that it's just amazing. So, very cool. Anyway, Michelle, do we have anybody with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room to be aware of?
Nobody with a hand up right now. Maureen was in the chat room, and I asked her, did she hear this when she was mentioned, and did you want to reply to anything? And she shared that she has found several books on the movie as well, and that wanted to let people know those are out there, and recommended them to let parents, you know, have a starting point to talk about the movie with their kids.
Yes, awesome. Yes, Maureen, I love the creativity with which you're approaching this, and sharing it with us is pretty powerful, pretty cool. What a gift.
I had a thought when you were opening the show and sharing about that moment when we abandon our being. And when you talk about it as a moment, it seems like, because it's so powerful and so significant, that it would be more in conscious memory for people. And so then I was thinking, well, maybe is it truly a moment or is it more of a process?
Well, my take would be that it is both. It is definitely a process that leads to it, but I think there is a moment where that loss of identification with being occurs and taking up and shifting out of joy, shifting out of being fueled by the presence of love and locking in and getting lost in the fear and hostility-based mind. So I think there is it's a whole series of events that leads to that, but my take would be there is a moment where that shift occurs and moment, that point where the loss of identification with being occurs, where the energy shift, it's like, you know, I talk about it as conversion. We start out as love-based beings and we get converted to hostility and fear-based beings by that input. And, you know, my purpose on the planet is to convert every mind, heart, and being on the planet. And, you know, the non-being mind has a cheap copy of everything that's real in the spiritual dimension. And the non-being's cheap copy of conversion is, I want you to come join my church. You need to become part of my religion in order for your life to work. And my take is, no, that's just the ego's cheap copy of conversion. If you join my church, then you affirm that I'm right. And what, the 3,100 or 3,200 sects just of the one religion, Christianity, everyone, 3,100 different sects saying, no, I've got a right. No, you got to join my church. If you don't get in my church, you're not going to be in hell, you know. And it's all just garbage. That's all just the non-being mind. But to recognize that conversion is really about shifting back to a love-based mind instead of an hostility and fear-based mind. Somebody convinced us by example or by the words and the behaviors they engaged in that hostility and fear would get us further than the presence of love would. And so to convert people back to where they stop, they think, and they just don't do a behavior based in hostility or fear. They just stop. It's like, finished, done, not doing that anymore. And that's the conversion that I'm wanting to support in the world. And it happens in a moment. And then once the moment happens, there are moments where the old hostility and fear-based mind come back in again, layers and layers and layers as we work through the dynamics that we're talking about. Does that fit? Does that make sense for you? And Dr. Tim, do you have any thoughts in that regard? It's a good question.
Well, I would agree that there's an aspect of both. My experience has been in doing my own work that there seem to be several different memories that I've recovered of times when another piece of it, another layer got let go, another layer was encountered. And so while some seem to be more intense than others, I'm not sure how it works in terms of if the first time that I had a memory, that my earliest memory is going to be the key one, or if one of the more advanced or older memories is going to turn out to be the key one. But I think it's both a series of events and a process, just from my personal experience.
Yeah, and I've seen a few times over the years, and one of the people I've seen do it was my own process, and that's how I came to this understanding, is that there comes a point where one touches in on such a deep level where that shift occurred that they have what, and I've seen it enough to title it, that I call it a whole body grief release. Every cell in the structure throws out, forgives that deep shuddering loss and pain to the point where the whole structure, every cell is involved in the process. And when I see that happen with someone, that's when everything changes. That's when a whole different possibility takes over someone's life. And we had a gentleman here last year who went through that process. You know, he arrived in a wheelchair, and throughout his time here, he had a cane or a walker in the classroom and would use the cane to hobble across to a table or a chair or what have you. And he went into that level of process. And the presence of love, the connection to that presence, the conversion that took place was so powerful that it was visible. And he didn't speak for 4 days, maybe said 5 words in 4 days. He just stayed in that space continuously. And that's what we're looking to do, to get people to engage in utilizing the process of forgiveness. And in utilizing that process of forgiveness, to come to the point where they really, truly function out of that state. And yes, there'll be other layers that will come up, but forevermore, they're functioning in the light.
That would be my take, my understanding of it, which, of course, is always open to adjustment.
Well, because you had talked about terrible twos, and, you know, I'm just thinking if there's some memories that fit for me closer to when I was five, and then I'm just wondering, like, would most people be done by, three or, you know, two or three, or are they still, you know, have that innocence and connectedness, you know, if they were nurtured, let's say, that maybe they're still hanging on to it at older than five?
Well, I don't think there's a defined, you know, date that it happens for anybody. You've heard me do a presentation where I talk about, you know, the average person, and you can tell whether somebody's made that shift or not, and that is, who's their God? What do they turn to when the stress is up and the chips are down? The person who turns to hostility or fear might talk a good game about how they love God, but they have no relationship and no care or concern for God whatsoever, except in this fantasy place in their heads. When the stress is up and the chips are down, what they trust is love. If you look at the average four-year-old, when the stress is up and the chips are down, rare is the four-year-old who still trusts in love and doesn't turn to whining and hostility and fear. And that to me is the loss of being. And so, you know, the 4-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 20-year-old, the 50-year-old, the 70-year-old, if they haven't been restored to love, then when the stress is up and the chips are down, what do they turn to? What do they trust? They turn to and they trust their hostility and fear. And as long as we trust that hostility and fear, we've lost our human lives. And so you've also heard me say that my take is that the average person is dead by the age of 4. If you define human life as this awesome active presence of love, then by the age of 4, most people are dead. It's gone. And the whole purpose of this work is to literally restore every mind, heart, and being on the planet to that state of being where they have love available to them. Now, sadly, the approach to that, because those masters that taught it initially became people that people made up religions in their name and out of their teaching. Sadly, the process sounds like something to do with religion. And so oftentimes, because religion has, you know, it's been bastardized by the presence of hostility or fear, you know, you listen to Yeshua and he says, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. But if you listen to many of his so-called followers, you'd think that he came to bring them condemnation and fear and guilt and shame and sinnership. And so, sadly, a lot of the true teachings have been made to sound like religion, and we've been subtly taught to reject that because of the way it's been bastardized. And so that's another major block for people to get through and to recognize the conversation about God is a conversation about love. It's not a conversation about some theological monstrosity made up by men to keep other men under control and keep them in fear. And that's one of the challenges in getting this work across to people, is to let go of that monstrosity made up by those who hadn't done their work, who could talk a good game about love,
But when the stress was up and the chips are down, turn to hostility or fear. You can tell who somebody's God is by what they turn to when the stress is up and the chips are down. That's, to me, that's the measure. And the way to determine whether or not we should engage in any given behavior is to look at the newborn child. And if you look at a particular behavior and in a circumstance you could imagine the newborn child doing it, then that's probably a good behavior to do. But if you can't imagine the newborn child doing it, you probably shouldn't be doing it because it's not human. Human is the active presence of love. Just because somebody has what looks like a human form doesn't mean there's any human life in them. So what we're working to do is to quite literally restore that human life, that awesome active presence of love that we're designed to function on. Any thoughts? Or anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Or anybody in the chat room that has a question for us? I'd love to hear it.
Rex is on the line. Rex is on the line.
Oh, great.
Let's say hi and comment.
And I know that that's a particular piece of work that Rex has worked on significantly over the years, so probably he's going to have some good input for us. Rex.
Well, thank you. That's a setup. And very possibly I do. One of the pieces that I know that didn't appear to be brought out right now, we've talked about in the past, is...
Rex?
Yeah.
Rex?
Yes.
Maybe you could back off of your microphone a little bit, and maybe it's just my phone, but you're cracking and breaking up a little bit. So maybe
well,
you could
probably
just
because
be
I
a
had,
little soft.
Yes, I will.
There you
I
go. That's
better. I
had
the microphone right in front of me. Yeah. The piece that I think is really important that plays such an important role in how this plays itself out is the habitual part of it. We come in as pure love. It's not a habit to that divine essence as far as knowing it's pure love. It is a habit. It just knows that. It's just a state of being. But the part that's the genetic piece, because our parents did that, and if everyone we know, and I personally haven't met anyone that didn't do this personally either, so it would, you know, suffice to say, maybe Tim would say that, and Michelle might say that as well. But there's a the majority of people, if not everyone, has done the same thing. So then that would also reflect that mom and dad and all of our mom and dads and all of their mom and dads and so on and so forth have done it. So we have a genetic piece that we're have inclination toward. And when we're moving in that direction of seeing that in our lives with our parents and with our peers around us who have also done that, it gets reinforced. And we have an inclination or a tendency to move in that direction, even though it isn't what we really want, nor is it the truth. And so that plays a really important role. And then I think we even go so far as to, you know, gradually deteriorate and break down the body so as to the idea, to fulfill the idea that we can get back to source if we kill a body. And so those two things didn't get brought out today. There's a lot on this topic, obviously. It's a major piece, and I think in every single interaction and reaction that happens in the world, and the movie was really, I think, a really wonderful opening to bringing it out. So those two things seem to be something that would be valuable to talk more about and maybe have a little discussion about, because they're it's almost like there's tremendous momentum for us to do this pattern. And there's little inertia and momentum to do the pattern of maintaining the integrity of life, of love, and being. So those are my two comments right now. I wondered if you had any thoughts or input on that, anyone.
Well, my take would be that you're on track, and it's a matter of step by step doing our work, as you know. Taking each layer, forgiving, and just a reminder to throw into the space that forgiveness in the context of this work means the tool with which I go inside myself and remove the energies that have converted me to an hostility and fear-based mind. That forgiveness is about removing those energies instead of reinforcing and playing out of them. And as we remove them,
we get to play in the world as actual true human beings. We get to trust that love is the way to go, and especially when the stress is up and the chips are down, which is, of course, when people tend to lose it to their power person. There are basically three different behaviors possible for someone who's functioning out of their power person dynamic. And the three behaviors go like this, and they're all related to stress levels. When there's no stress, notice that people do whatever they did to get along with the power person. So if somebody's normally a jovial, happy person, that's how they got along with their power person, then when there's no stress, that's what they'll do. If what they did was when the stress started to build in their power, in their lives, then what they'll do is they'll do whatever they did to resist and survive with their power person. So let's say that when the stress was up in the power person relationship with the child and what they did was got snarky and mouthy, then you'll notice that when the stress starts to move in this person, and you know, how many times have you seen or heard of the situation where the cop stops the young man for going 6 miles over the limit? Okay. Is in snarky, power person. If he kept quiet and said, yes, sir, thank you, sir, then the cop probably would have just sent him on down the road and said, have a good day, be safe. But because he couldn't control his power person dynamic to the stress of the presence of an authority figure who's questioning his behavior, all of a sudden he ends up in a jail cell. How many times does that one happen? And then when one becomes the third level of behavior, when one becomes ultra-stressed, then what they'll do is they'll do the behavior that their power person did to them that they hated the most. If you watch anybody in hostility or fear and their stress is up, you are always going to be accurate if you ask them the question, although you may not be safe to ask them the question because the energy may get turned on you. But you will always be accurate to ask the question, you know, I noticed that you just raged at your child. How did it feel when your power person raged at you? Now, if that person is honest, they'll stop, they'll take a breath, they'll go inside and they'll start to process the rage that their power person poured on them. If they're not willing, if they don't have a love of truth and don't want to do that, then they'll turn the rage on on you for asking the question. But it's just as definable as day follows night. You can tell exactly what a person's power person did to them when you watch them under stress and you watch the behavior they do. Their behavior does not vary. I remember working with one man who was actually in his 60s, and he'd been sober for 30 years. He'd been an alcoholic for 30 years and been a sober for 30 years. And he actually runs a large AA and NA website. And I explained that power person thing about when the stress is up and the chips are down, people will do what their power person did that they hated the most. And he said, that's just not true. I know from experience that's not true, because when I was a kid, my father beat me mercilessly, like mercilessly on a daily basis. And I've never hit my child. And he was, you know, kind of dug in and kind of hard on that. It's like, you know, I know it's not true. And then with the next question, I could have blown him over with a feather. I literally could have knocked him over with a feather. The next question was, I got it. So you had enough integrity to keep from using your fists on your child. But how much time do you still spend every day trying to control your fists? It was just like, oh, my God. Whew. Because it took tremendous will. He didn't have the tools to resolve the throwing of the fists around, but he had the fortitude to stop himself. But it was a struggle. Even after 30 years of sobriety and all the work that he'd done through AA, it was still a daily struggle for him to refrain from using his fists. So that's the power person game, and definitely every aspect of that, piece by piece by piece, those energies are forgiven when we engage in the forgiveness process. And it's your thoughts and questions, Rex.
It sure does. And talking about how that moment in time when we gave up our awareness, and then Michelle asked a very good question, it's like a process or is it a moment in time? And the answer was, yeah, probably both. And I would agree it's both. Tim said something to me about a year ago that was really poignant in the moment. And he said, recognize just because you're immersed or you appear to be immersed in that experience, and I'm paraphrasing my language in here, just because you appear to be immersed in the experience of healing that inner moment, that moment of disconnection, of that loss of awareness, doesn't mean that everybody is working on that same piece in that moment. And what it spoke to me was how, regardless of where we're at, we'll take, you know, and I have done that as well and was doing it at the time, but I would take my experience of processing through that moment in time that spanned over millennia. It, you know, because it wasn't just the moment in time when I did it. As I open it up, I start to see that there's a much bigger picture that I unfold with that and I experience. And so it's lots of depth and width to it. And what I did is I realized that I had taken it and really started clothing it more and more with my clients, and then I would kind of move them in that direction rather than allowing them to be where they are and come to that place on their own. So it was a really good insight that Tim had given me at that time to recognize that. And I, if he would have asked me before he said that and before I actually got that after that, if he'd have said, you know, you might be just taking your information and making that in your clients. Oh, no, Tim, I'm not doing that. And I think both were true. I probably wasn't doing it exclusively, but I found that when it was pervasive in my awareness, because I was diligently working on it, that it became very obvious to me that a lot of people or everyone was working on it, but not everybody was ready to work on it. And that led into the other piece there, and you're talking about power person dynamic and the part of Michelle's question about how it starts to open up. There, as my vitality increases and I'm able to see the depth and width of my power person dynamic, and I see how that interplays, there was a point in time where I went probably, I'm going to say 8-9 months, maybe even a year, without having any types of, you know, anger, quote, anger outbursts, because it used to be what I would do. And then one day, it's just like, boom, it happened again. And it was such a relatively shocking experience for me, because I would have, if you'd asked me, I'd have said, oh, no, I think I've got that handled now. I've got that. And what I learned from that experience, along with many others similar, is that just because I touched into that level that I had the vitality to heal and to bring up and heal, doesn't mean I'm done. And I really stopped saying, oh, I'm done with that. Because it was really quite a tongue-in-cheek experience that I learned, is like, holy moly, don't say I'm done with anything, really. I mean, if I really am, good. But the likeliness of opening up another piece when I raise my vitality even higher is going to come up, and I'm going to be surprised. Rather, for me, it's better just to say, hey, I'm in process. You know, I'm healing, I'm growing, I'm learning. And it seems like every day I learn more about not only the dynamics of the power person, but the dynamics of what my parents may have been experiencing in their lives when I was a young child, and also what I was experiencing in my life when my children were young, and just starting to see a broader perspective of how it all plays together. So it really is a dynamic, experiential life that we're capable of living. And of recently, the challenges that I've been experiencing on very deep levels have come up. I never would have guessed that I would have been saying that I don't feel secure. You know, I feel, wake up in the morning and feel insecure and feel incapable, or having the thoughts that I'm insecure, or I'm not capable of accomplishing or doing the things that I'm setting in motion to do.
And Rex,
yes, please.
Rex, and notice, yes, that that's what you have to process to be finished with the anger. That the anger is the drug that anesthetizes against that pain. And good yes. chance, and just to clarify, when you talked about, you know, I went through this time period of 7 or 8 months and I felt like I was finished with my anger, and then all of a sudden there it was again, was the dynamic that your power person expressed when the stress was up and the chips are down one of anger?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So my suggestion would be, it would probably be helpful to do worksheets on using that anger as a drug, as an anesthetic for feeling insecure, and maybe even do a couple of vicarious worksheets where you actually do a worksheet for your dad as though you were him. Breathe into his skin, breathe into his space, and let yourself touch into that anger and, you know, whatever the event is, and actually go through it, and you'll probably find that there was the same insecurity in dad that comes up and that is used to cover the pain. You know, it's insecurity. I'm not good enough. I can't do it, whatever it is. That's pretty painful stuff. And so what happens? And it also comes with, when we have those kinds of thoughts, it comes with a feeling of great weakness and helplessness.
Mm.
Hey, none of us real men ever want to feel helplessness and weakness. So what do? Use the drug of anger. Use the drug of hostility to cover it. Now I don't have to feel that. I don't have to deal with that. And then what we do is we reinforce in others with that anger their weakness and their insecurity, and just that's how it's passed on to the next generation.
Hmm. And that's really good, Michael, on many levels. I actually, it's one of those things that I could easily have a conversation about, but I don't think that I've ever done. And specifically,
nope.
I've offered that, and but to do a worksheet and have my dad, and as you were talking about it, put him, you know, do it in almost like the first person. I know the technique. I've done it with other people, but I haven't done it with my dad. And that's interesting. Not in this venue, you know, not in this topic.
Right. It'd be powerful.
Yeah, real good. And just the giving recognition to that in the moment, it was like, oh, yeah, you just felt really sad. And this insecurity comes up in such obscure ways. It comes up in areas that I'm actually very adept at, you know, that I'm good at. And I like in my work, I feel very competent in working with people. Yet I'll have that feeling that'll come up and go, well, what am I doing this for? You know, I'm not that good at this. And I'm going, what? Like, wait a minute. And so
well, and
that's
look at,
good.
Yeah, look at one of your chosen professions was at one time to be a salesman. And, you know, you look at the good old classic salesman smile and slap on the back. And a lot of that's about the cover for the insecurity. And so what is the traditional salesman doing? It, you know, turns a lot of people off because they're like, yeah, hey, how's it going? Yeah, hey, you look pretty good. Let me give you a slap on the back. You give me a slap on the back and let's not acknowledge there might be some insecurity here and something I need to deal with. Let's just stay with this slap on the back kind of stuff and, you know, and be good salesmen. It's just, you know, it all ties together, and all the dynamics that we play out are just part of that process. And of course,
and for all of them,
all of that energy has to come up for healing.
Well, it's definitely coming up.
Awesome.
So
that's a good
I'm
thing.
Committed to doing some worksheets. Yes, that's good. I'll do that. You know, if not while we're on the program, I'll definitely do it when I hang up. So I have some time today to do that and do some work on that. So that's,
cool. Well,
that's
also,
very helpful.
You got my support 2,000%. That'll open a space for all of us on the next level. Important
well,
work.
I appreciate it. Well, thank you. And that combined with, I think it's very beneficial to have, like we're having a conversation about these moments in time where we, you know, gradually disengaged, because that's been my experience. I used to think that it was just that one moment in time, and I think you're right, Michael, about how you described it. But what my experience is that there were layers of it, and there was a moment that seemed to happen that I have touched into that I shut it down, and then I put it kind of in that cave, like the shaman talk about, you know, and then I put a guard up. But there was a lot of events that I have experienced led up to that, and then events that happened after that reinforced that lockdown, shutdown. So, and those are the things that we do the work on and that you're describing right now by just saying, hey, try this with your dad, you know, and see what happens, you know, and do some worksheets around that. So thank you. And there might be somebody else who'd like to share. So
glad
I'll
to be on the team.
Up. Yeah, thank you.
All right, Rex.
And
thanks for being on
everybody.
The team.
You bet.
All right, blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
646-200-4169. If you're in on one of those radio stations where we can't see you in our control panel, we'd love to hear your voice. If you have a question, a thought, a contribution to make to the conversation, we'd love to have you be part of it. I'm actually sitting in Theodosia, Missouri right now. We've got this rainy day, a dark, cloudy sky, and the weather's, the temperature's really quite nice. It's probably only about 70, maybe 4, 75 degrees, so it's pretty sweet, and it's actually been a cool summer so far, at least since we got home. And we're just kind of rocking along, getting ready. Next Wednesday, Jeannie comes in and back from her family reunion. And Michael Coughlin flies in at the same time. So we'll be, I think we're going to meet Ari in Springfield. We found a new Peruvian restaurant that we're going to take everybody to before we head back to Heartland and get things ready for Food, Fun, and Forgiveness, which starts a week from Friday. So a week from this Friday, we'll start a 10-day Food, Fun, Forgiveness, sort of an economy program. And what we do in the Food, Fun, and Forgiveness is we'll do work projects on the property and on the computers during the day. In the evenings, we'll do workshops. And on Saturday, we'll do Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. So we'll be starting that on the 11th of July. If you want to join us, it's going to be a small group. And so we'd love to have you be part of that process and share the tools and the process with us. And then once we complete that 10 days, then we'll move into the next step in the process, and that is that we're going to do a 16-day Laws of Living Intensive, and that will begin on July the 24th and go through August the 8th. And right now that's the only intensive that we have confirmed at this moment. And so if you're interested in coming and joining us for that, or one of the other intensives is of interest, we basically, with the intensity of this tour and what we've got scheduled for next winter and starting up with the television programming and all that's going on, we decided to, because it was going to be such a small season, to just compress our summer season into these two events. Unless another one of the intensives builds, we were planning on a 16-day codependence communication practicum, a 9-day why is this happening to me again, and Jeannie was going to do an 8-day healing the whole woman. But the registration was just small. It seems since 9/11 that it's kind of difficult to get people to come out to the Ozarks. Not sure what that's all about, but we're on go with these two workshops, and if you want to join us. Again, it'll be small, intensive, extra intensive because the groups are going to be small, so there'll be more personal one-on-one work and support in the process. And so if you want to come and join us, we'd be delighted to have you here. So, Michelle, what's happening?
Well, your comment about the Peruvian restaurant caught my ear. I'm wondering if you're going to have Cui, the roasted guinea pig. That's especially
well,
there.
I won't be doing anything with guinea pigs at any time in the next 2,000 years. I promise you. No.
Good,
no,
good
I won't. But it was interesting because this restaurant has a what attracted it to us. It's an awesome decor, but it had an interesting menu of vegetarian items, and then there were, of course, meats. And most of the items had meat on them and were vegetarian. So we made the request, and when we got the meal, it was, you know, basically the meal that was being served to others without the meat. And so I talked to the owner of the restaurant and said, well, you know, it's kind of a thing that happens with vegetarians is we get other people's leftovers. And so what we'd like to do is, you know, you're going to take the meat off of it, put some extra vegetables on it so that we have, you know, a real entree. And he informed me, and I don't recall the particular style of Peruvian cooking that we're doing, but he said that actually it's a little bit of the reverse, that the dietary regimen of this particular Peruvian group was totally, strictly vegetarian. And so all they're doing is taking the meat off and going back to the original Peruvian recipe. and that they added the meat because that's, you know, the demand for dead animals in this country is kind of high. People don't seem to have put two and two together that, let's see, swine flu, bird flu, you know, go through the diseases, the organisms. You know, there's never been anything tainted with these organisms that didn't come from animals. And, you know, people need to really think about that. But in any event, it was a pretty cool restaurant, really fabulous decor. And so we'll be doing that. You can picture us next Wednesday afternoon doing that and then heading back to Heartland to get ready for people to arrive on Friday.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're leaving the Cui alone. All right, we do have somebody with a hand up. It's area code 781. Not sure where that is, but who do we have? Let's say.
Hi, Michael and Michelle. It's Ron from Massachusetts.
Well, hey there, good sir. How do you be?
I'd be awesome. And it's the young man you were talking about at the beginning of the call, right?
Yes, yes. You are the young man that opened that conversation.
Long time no talk.
Yeah. Yes, it's been all of 56 minutes, so we've got about 3.5 minutes left.
I just want to acknowledge the, who was it that asked the question about, what is it a process or a moment? Whoever
that
was
Michelle's question, I think.
Michelle, I love that question. I think it's an awesome question, and I love the responses that you and Dr. Tim and Rex all gave. I particularly... I've heard a lot of what you've had to say about it, Michael, and I'm integrating that over time. I was particularly moved by what Rex had to say about it as well. It reminds me, I've talked a lot about how we slip into materialism in our culture, and do we live in a thing-based world or a process world? And the thing... If you watch, I've learned if you watch a newborn's eyes, they move across the room with this beautiful continuity. And if you watch an adult's eyes, or if most of us try it ourselves, the eyes jerk and move because we keep getting stopped on things, and our eyes are. And when I first heard you speak about that moment, I got afraid, like, am I going to be kind of assaulted by this horrible moment? And then as I learned more to be more in process and more to see the world in process, and I started to observe things like the birth of a child, I realized that this isn't something that, you know, you're not all of a sudden walking down the street one day and then a woman isn't just walking down the street one day and then all of a sudden, bang, they're in labor giving birth, you know, like right in that moment of... there's this all this process that goes along with it, and with that kind of understanding of process, I started to feel more relaxed and more encouraged.
Down to about a minute, Ron.
To deal with those aspects of myself, because I've and that's it. That's really what I wanted to say. I hope it made sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, letting those layers come up, and as Rex described so powerfully, gee, I thought I was done with this, and I was at the level of vitality I was at. You know, let's say I've got a level 8 toxicity that is filled with rage, and I'm at a level 5 vitality. I can't process my level 8 rage. So I might process my 5, my 4, my 3, my 2, my 1, and think, now I'm done. But then, when I get to a level 6 vitality, I get to process my level 6 rage. When I get to a 7, so we get to revisit those things and clean out deeper, more intense layers. But as you acquire the skills using the tools, you get a whole new empowerment. You know, that's another piece in the Inside Out movie that I thought they just demonstrated so powerfully is once Joy Riley process this sadness and heal it, all of a sudden they install a whole new control panel, bigger control panel, whole new set of spiritual faculties show up, new empowerment, new tools, which empower us to go to the next level of what we need to deal with. So it's always moving in the right direction, and we're down to a few seconds, so I'll just say thanks for joining us. Bring a stranger to the show tomorrow. Blessings. Bye-bye.